Oscar Wilde, Henry IV at Oxford. I have been told that the ambition of the every dramatic club is to act Henry IV. I am not surprised that the spirit of comedy is fervent in this play, as is the spirit of chivalry. It is a heroic pageant as well as a heroic poem, and like most of Shakespeare's historical dramas, it contains an extraordinary number of throughoutly good acting parts, each of which is absolutely individual in character, and each of which contributes to the evolution of the plot. Rumor from time to time has brought in tidings of the proposed productions by the banks of the Cam, but it seems at the last moment Box and Fox has always had to be substituted in the bill. To Oxford belongs the honor of having been the first to present on this stage this noble play, and the production, which I saw last week, was in every way worthy of that lovely town, that mother of sweetness and of light. For in spite of the roaring of the young lions at the Union and the screaming of the rabbits in the home of the vivisector, in spite of Keble College and the tramways and the sporting prints, Oxford still remains the most beautiful thing in England, and nowhere else are life and art so exquisitely blended, so perfectly made one. Indeed, in most other towns, art has often to present herself in the form of a reaction against the sordid ugliness of ignoble lives. But at Oxford, she comes to us as an exquisite flower born of the beauty of life and expressive of life's joy. He finds her home by the Isis, as once she did by the Idises. The Magdalen walks, and the Magdalen cloisters are as dear to her as wherever the silver olives of Colonus, and the golden gateway of the house of Pallas. She cowers with fan-like tracery the vaulted entrance to Christchurch Hall, and looks out from the windows of Merton. Her feet have starred the common calyps, and she gathers fritillaries in the river fields. To her, the clamour of the schools and the dullness of the rectory room are a weariness and a vexation of spirit. She seeks not to define virtue, and cares little for the categories. She smiles on the swift athlete whose plastic grace has pleased her. She rejoices in the young barbarians at their games. She watches the rowers from the reedy bank, and gives myrtle to her lovers, and laurel to her poets, and rue to those who talk wisely in the street. She makes the earth lovely to all who dream with Keats. She opens high heaven to all who soar with Shelley, and turning away her head from pedant doctor and Philistine, she has welcomed to her shrine a band of youthful actors, knowing that they had sought with much ardour for the stern secret of Melpomene, and caught with much gladness the swift laughter of Thalia. To me, this ardour and this gladness were the two most fascinating qualities of the Oxford performance, as indeed they are qualities which are necessary to any fine dramatic production. For without quick and imaginative observation of life, the most beautiful play becomes dull in presentation. And what is not conceived in delight by the actor can give no delight to all others. I know that there are many who consider that Shakespeare is more for the study than for the stage. With this view, I do not for a moment agree. Shakespeare wrote the plays to be acted, and we have no right to alter the form which he himself selected for the full expression of his work. Indeed, many of the beauties of that work can be adequately conveyed to us only through the actor's art. As I sat in the town hall of Oxford the other night, the majesty of the mighty lines of the play seemed to me to gain new music from the clear young voices that uttered them, and the ideal branch of the heroism to be made more real to the spectators by the chivalrous bearings, the noble gesture, and the fine passion of its exponents. Even the dresses had their dramatic value. Their ecological accuracy gave us immediately, on the rise of the curtain, a perfect picture of the time. and the knights and nobles moved across the stage in the flowing robes of peace and the burnished steel of battle. We needed no dreary chorus to tell us in what age or land the place action was passing, for the 15th century, at all the dignity and grace of its apparel, was living actually before us, and the delicate harmonies of colour struck from the first dominant note of beauty, which added to the intellectual realism of archaeology the sensuous charm of art. For the individual actors, Mr. McKinnon's Prince Hall was a most gay and graceful performance, lit here and there with charming touches of princely dignity and of noble feeling. Mr. Coleridge Falstaff was full of delightful humour, though perhaps at times he did not take us sufficiently to his confidence. An audience looks at a tragedian, but a comedian looks at his audience. However, he gave much pleasure to everyone. Mr. Bourchier Hotspur was really most remarkable. Mr. Bourchier has a fine stage presence and a beautiful voice, produces his effects by a method as dramatically impressive as it is artistically right. Once or twice he seemed to me to spoil his last line by walking through it. The part of Henry Percy is one full of climaxes, which must not be let slip. But still, there was always a freedom and spirit in his style, which was very pleasing, and his delivery of the colloquial passages I thought excellent, notably of that in the first act. "What call the place? A plague upon it, it's in Gloucester. 'Twas where the mad Cap Duke his uncle kept, his uncle York." Lines by the way in which Campbell made a great effect. Mr. Bourchier has the opportunity of a fine career on the English stage. I hope he will take advantage of it. Among the minor parts in the play, Glandower, Mortimer, and Sir Brihad Vernon were capitally acted. Worcester was a performance of some subtlety. Mrs. Woods was a charming Lady Percy, and Lady Edward Spencer Chortle, as Mortimer's wife, made us all believe that we understood Welsh. Her dialogue and her song were most pleasing bits of artistic realism, which fully accounted for the Celtic chair at Oxford. But though I have mentioned particular actors, the real value of the whole representation was to be found in its absolute unity, in its delicate sense of proportion, and in that breadth of effect which is to be got only by the most careful elaboration of detail. I have rarely seen a production better stage managed. Indeed, I hope that the university will take some official notice of this delightful work of art. Why should not degrees be granted for good acting? Are they not given to those who misunderstand Plato and who mistranslate Aristotle? And should the artist be passed over? No. To Prince Hall, Hotspur, and Falstaff, Dissilies should be gracefully offered. I feel sure they would be gracefully accepted. To the rest of the company, the crimson of the sheepskin hood might be assigned honoris causa. To the internal confusion of the Philistine, and the rage of the industrious and the dull. Thus would Oxford confer honour of herself, and the artist be placed in his proper position. However, whether or not convocation recognises the claims of culture, I hope that the Oxford Dramatic Society will produce every summer for us some noble play like Henry IV. For in plays of this kind, plays which deal with bygone times, there is always this peculiar charm that they combine in one exquisite presentation the passions that are living with the picturesqueness that is dead. And when we have the modern spirit given to us in an antique form, the very remoteness of that form can be made a method of increased realism. This was Shakespeare's own attitude towards the ancient world. This is the attitude we in this century should adopt toward his plays. And with a feeling akin to this, it seemed to me that these brilliant young Oxonians were working. If it was so, their aim is the right one. For while we look to the dramatists to give romance to realism, we ask of the actors to give realism to romance.